You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
This show is supported by State Farm. You have insurance for your home, your health, and your car. Why don't you have insurance for your small business? So many small business owners think they don't need or don't even know about small business insurance. Protecting a source of revenue is one thing, but so is protecting all of your hard work and your team members. State Farm agents are all small business owners too, so they know how to help small business owners choose personalized policies that fit their budgets. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Which of the world's wiseacres, I wonder, was responsible for the aphorism that the best things in life are to be found at its edges? It's too vague, of course. So much depends on what you mean by best and edges. Most of us prefer the central. It is safe. You know where you are. But amusing? Well, hardly. Quite so, as my friend Mr. Bloom would have said. But then Mr. Bloom has now ventured over the borderline. He is, I imagine, interested in edges no longer. I've been reminded of him again, as if there were any need, by an advertisement in the Times. It announces that his house, Montresor, is for sale. This charming freehold residential property, 38 acres, the matured grounds of unusual beauty, I don't deny it. But was it quite discreet to describe the house as imposing? A pair of slippers in my possession prompts this query. It is important in such matters to be clear and precise, and, alas, all I can say about Mr. Bloom can only be vague and inconclusive, as indeed he was. It was an afternoon in May. I'd been to see a friend who, after a long illness, was now creeping back into the world again. It is a relief to leave a sick room, to breathe freely again after that stagnant atmosphere. I even found myself whistling as I climbed into my two-seater. I released the brake. She leapt to life. I felt adventurous. It would be miserably unenterprising to go back by the way I'd come. I would just chance my way home. 2 or 3 miles further on, I caught my first glimpse of Mr. Bloom's house, of Montresor. And the mere quiet, diffident looks of it brought me instantly to a standstill. Imposing. It must have been built around 1750, and at second sight was merely of pleasing proportions. To all appearance, it was vacant. High-grown trees towered around it, chiefly chestnuts. The sun had set, and a diffused light hung over the walls and roof. I had been debating whether to approach nearer on foot or to drive boldly in. I chose the second alternative, with a faint notion in my mind perhaps that it would ensure me, if necessary, a speedier retreat. But then premonitions are apt to display themselves a little clearer in retrospect. Anyhow, if I had walked up to the house, that night would not have been spent with Mr. Bloom. But it looked harmless enough, and I drove under the chestnut trees to the entrance. I sat on in the car, idly surveying the scene. No notice whatever seemed to have been taken of my intrusion. So, presently I got out, and mooned off to the end of the shallow stone-vase terrace. Only a dense shrubbery beyond. I sighed and turned back. I came to the conclusion that the place was unoccupied. Indeed, my foot was actually on the step of the car when, as if at a summons, I turned my head and discovered not only that the door was now open, but that a figure, Mr. Bloom's, was standing on the threshold. Mr. Bloom, a memorable figure. He was well over 6 feet in height. He was both stout and fat, and his clothes hung loosely upon him. a black morning coat and waistcoat, brown trousers and well-cut boots. His head was bald, but his face was bushily bearded. He was surveying me from under very powerful magnifying spectacles. "Are you interested in my house?" he was saying. I made the lamest apologies, adding some trivial comment on the picturesqueness of the scene. But of this I am certain. The one thing uppermost in my mind, even at this stage in our brief acquaintance, was the desire not to continue it. Far from countenancing this inclination, however, Mr. Bloom was suggesting that I should come in. There was a suppressed eagerness in the eyes behind those glasses. And yet, even so, why should I have distrusted him? He pushed the door open. The glimpse within decided me. For the hall beyond was peculiarly attractive. It was panelled in light wood, the carving on its pilasters tinged with gilt. Empty, it would have been a fascinating room, but just now it was grotesquely packed with old furniture. It might have been some antique dealer's interior, prepared for a moonlight flit. But having thus enticed me in under his roof, Mr. Bloom rapidly motioned me on. At the dusky twist of the corridor, I found him awaiting me, his hand on an inner door. "This is a study," he informed me. "One moment, though, I think I neglected to shut the outer door." Dimmed old Persian rugs lay on the floor. There was a large writing table. The immense armchairs were covered in vermilion Morocco leather, and the walls were lined with books. The lofty chimney-piece was surmounted by mouldings in plaster, some pagan scene. I was looking out of the long windows when Mr. Bloom reappeared. "You are a lover of books," he was murmuring, and we were soon conversing amiably enough on the diversions of literature. At last I bluntly held out my hand, and in spite of his protestations, made my way out of the room. Mr. Bloom followed me, cooing his regrets that I could spare him no more time. "The garden, my china." I persisted nevertheless, and myself opened the outer door, and there, in the twilight, sat my car. I had actually taken my seat in it, when I noticed that in a moment of absent-mindedness I must not only have locked the gears, but that the Yale gear key was missing. I searched my pockets, leapt out and searched them again, and not only in vain, but without the faintest recollection of having even touched the key. I turned to Mr. Bloom. He was watching my efforts with an almost paternal concern. "I've mislaid the key."
"Is it of importance?"
"It's the gear key," I snapped. "She's fixed, immovable, useless. I wish to heaven I..."
"Most vexatious, dear me. Do you think by any chance, Mr. Dash, you can have put it into your pocket?"
I stared at him. The suggestion was little short of imbecile, and yet he had evidently had the sagacity to look for my name on the license. "Where's the nearest town?" I said.
"The nearest... let me see. Come in again, we must get a map."
I produced my own from the car, but only an owl could have read it in that light. There was no alternative. I followed Mr. Bloom into the house again and on into his study. He lit a couple of candles and we sat at the writing table and examined the map. The position was ludicrous. Montresor was miles from the nearest village. I folded my map and sat glooming.
"But why be disturbed?" he entreated me. "Why, a misadventure? But of no importance. You will give me the pleasure of being my guest for the night. Say no more."
I protested and once again began searching my pockets.
"Ah, I see what is in your mind. Think nothing of it. Yes, yes, yes. Comforts, convenience curtailed, I agree. But my good housekeeper always prepares a meal sufficient for two. Mere habit, Mr. Dash. And I will forage for myself." He beamed. "As a matter of fact, I am preparing to leave," he told me, "as soon as it is convenient. Meanwhile, I camp on the ground floor. It amused my secretary, this system of picnicking, poor fellow. At least for a while."
He came to a standstill on the threshold of the room into which he was leading me. Candles burned on the oak table set for our evening meal.
"I must explain," he was saying, "that my secretary has left me. He's left me for good. He is dead."
He glanced over his shoulder into the corridor.
"I miss him," On the other hand, we mustn't allow our personal feelings to interfere with the enjoyment of what I'm afraid is a lamentably modest little meal. It was by no means a modest little meal. Our cold bouillon was followed by a pair of spring chickens, the white sauce on their breasts adorned with fragments of cucumber, truffle, and mushroom. There was an asparagus salad, and neighbouring it were silver dishes of meringues and a wine jelly thickly clotted with cream. Champagne was our only wine. Between mouthfuls, Mr. Bloom indulged in general conversation of the exclamatory order. It covered a pretty wide autobiographical field. He told me of his boyhood in Montresor. The estate had been in his family for 2 centuries. For some years he'd shared it with his 3 sisters, all now dead. By the time we'd set to work on some Camembert cheese, Mr. Bloom's remarks about his secretary had become almost aggrieved.
"He was of indispensable use to me in my work. Indispensable. We differed in our views, of course. No human beings ever see perfectly eye to eye on such a topic. In a word, the occult."
He laid his left hand on the table.
"We succeeded in attaining the most curious and interesting results from our little experiments. I could astonish you."
I tried in vain to welcome the suggestion.
"My own personal view," he explained, "is that his ill health was in no way due to these investigations. My secretary, Mr. Dash, was found dead in his bed. That is, in his bedroom. Speaking for myself, I should prefer to go quickly when I have to go at all." "You will agree, my dear sir, that to see eye to eye with an invalid for any protracted period is a strain. Not a happy youth, ever, but still meaning well. We shared the same interests. He had his own views, but was at times exceedingly obstinate about them. He had little staying power."
He refilled his glass.
"You know the general process, of course."
And he forthwith embarked on a long and tedious discourse concerning the uses of the planchette, of automatic writing, table tapping, and all the other paraphernalia of the spiritualistic sales. Nothing I could say or do, not even deliberate yawning, had the least effect on Mr. Bloom's fluency. Lung trouble appeared to have been the cause of his secretary's final resignation. But if the unfortunate young man had night after night been submitted to the experience I was now enduring, boredom alone would have accounted for it. The cascade of talk suddenly ended. Mr. Bloom fixed me in silence under his glasses.
"You yourself have possibly dabbled a little in my hobby?"
I had indeed. In my young days, my family had possessed an elderly female friend, a Miss Allgood. She was gaunt, loquacious, and affectionate, and she had a consuming interest in the other world. I hear her now.
"On the other side, my dear Charles. Another plane, Charles."
I used to go to tea with her occasionally, and she would bring out the little round table and the wine glass and the cardboard alphabet, and we would ask questions of the unseen, and she would become flushed and excited, while she urged me now to empty my mind and now to concentrate. And we enjoyed astonishing revelations. These spiritualistic answers to our cross-examination were at the same time so unintelligibly intelligent and yet so useless that I had been cured once and for all of the faintest interest in the other side. I explained this to Mr. Bloom. "I don't say that you get nowhere, but my personal opinion is that the whole business is a silly and dangerous waste of time." His eyes never wavered.
"Quite so. But not exactly nowhere, it may be."
And then as I sat looking at him, his face went out, so to speak. It became vacant. The unspeculating eyes remained open, but he, Mr. Bloom, was gone. And for perhaps 2 minutes I sat there in a solitude I do not covet to experience again. Yet, as I realized even then, Mr. Bloom had succeeded in this miserable maneuver merely by a trick. The next instant his bluish eyes became occupied, and he looked at me with a leer of triumph.
He gave me no time to reflect on this piece of buffoonery.
So, he was informing me, shut us up or shut us down, we are what we are. And what you've been saying, my dear Mr. Dash, amuses me.
Extraordinary. Most amusing.
Quite so. Like a fool, I mentioned Miss Allgood.
I see. A superannuated novice. You pay your money and you take your choice.
Pooh. Banal.
I hotly defended my old friend.
Ah, indeed, an old maid. Have no fear, Mr. Dash, she is not on my visiting list.
With that, he took out his watch, a gold half-hunter.
Now, let me see. 9 o'clock. Just 9. We have a long evening before us. Believe me, I am exceedingly grateful for your company, and regret that. But I see you've already condoned an old man's foibles.
There was something curiously aimless, even pathetic, in the tone of that last remark. He rose from the table, with one of the candlesticks in his hand. In his study, a dusky moonlight loomed beyond the windows.
And now, Mr. Dash, your room. Where shall we be put?
He stood looking at me.
My secretaries now? But one has reluctances, perhaps. I myself sleep in here.
He stepped across and drew aside a curtain hung between the bookcases. But there was not light enough to see beyond.
The room, I propose, is also on this floor, so we should not, if need be far apart. Eh? What think we? Well, now, come this way.
He led me out to a room along the corridor. It was a bed and a sitting room combined, and its curtains and upholstery were of pale purple. The bed was in a corner by the window, and there again the dusky moonlight showed. This was the last place on earth. These walls, these colours, this bookcase, that table, which Mr. Bloom's secretary had set eyes on before setting out, not to return.
How's that, then? My host watched me.
I mumbled my thanks.
Capital, cried Mr. Bloom. Eureka! My only apprehension. Well, you know how sensitive people can be. I leave you reconciled, then, my dear Mr. Dash. You will find me in the study.
He lit the candles on the writing table and withdrew. I took one of the candles and glanced at the books. They were chiefly of fiction and a little poetry. On the writing table were a couple more, and a black book, its cover stamped diary, and on the flyleaf, S.S. Champneys. I turned to the last entry, dated just months before. Just a few scribbled words. Not me, at any rate. Not me. But even if I could get away for... The ink was smudged. A mere scrap of handwriting, and that hasty smudge of ink. They resembled an incantation. I shut the book and turned away. To my astonishment, a log fire was burning handsomely in the grate when I returned to the study, and Mr. Bloom, having drawn up two of his voluminous armchairs in front of it, was now encased in one of them.
I hope, was his greeting, you found everything needful, Mr. Dash. In the circumstances, not that you wouldn't find a complete trousseau in the wardrobe. My secretary, in fact, was inclined to the foppish. No blame, no blame. Fine feathers, Mr. Dash.
It is, thank heaven, an unusual experience to be compelled to spend an evening as the guest of a stranger one distrusts. Mr. Bloom did his best to make himself amusing. We discussed music and art. We talked of chance and dreams and disease and heredity, edged on to woman and skated rapidly away. In the midst of a discourse on the progress of human thought, he suddenly inquired if I cared for the game of backgammon.
And why not? Or solitaire, Mr. Dash, a grossly underestimated amusement.
But all this badinage, these high spirits, were clearly an elaborate disguise. He was keeping it up, to keep me up. And his attention was divided. One, at least, of those long, hairy ears was cocked in another direction. And at last the question that had been on my tongue most of the evening popped out almost inadvertently.
I asked if he was expecting a visitor. At the moment, his back was turned on me. He was rummaging in a cupboard for glasses to accompany the decanter of whiskey he had produced. His head turned slyly.
A visitor? Here? No. You amuse me. Callers? Oh, thank heaven, not so. You came, you saw, but you did not expect a welcome. The unworthy tenant of Montresor took you by surprise, confess it. And why not? What if you yourself were my looked-for visitor? What then? Yes, yes, I agree. I was on the watch, patiently, patiently. In due time, your charming little car appears at my gate. You pause. I say to myself, here he is. Company at last. Discussion. Pow-wow. Even controversy, perhaps. Why not? I step downstairs. And here we are. I assured Mr. Bloom that if it had not been for the loss of my key, I shouldn't have stayed 5 minutes. He chuckled. Howard, are we not forgetting that such little misadventures are merely part and parcel of the general plan?
What general plan?
Mr. Dash, pray let us no longer treat each other like witnesses in the witness box. Have a little whiskey? Pure malt? A tot? One of the few exasperating things about my poor secretary, Mr. Champneys, was his aversion to alcohol. His own word. £300 a year, Mr. Dash, no less. And everything found. Soda water or Apollinaris?
In sheer chagrin, I drank the stuff and rose to turn in. Not a bit of it. With covert glances at his watch, Mr. Bloom kept me there until it was long past midnight. And try as he might to conceal it, the disquietude that had peeped out earlier in the evening became more and more obvious. Once he raised his hand and openly sat listening.
Tell me, Mr. Dash, was I deceived into thinking I heard a distant knocking? In a house as large as this, articles of some value, we read of violence.
I inquired with clumsy irony if there would be anything remarkable in a knocking. Don't your friends from the other side ever volunteer a rap or two on their own account?
A rap or two? He echoed me blandly, but his lips trembled.
I had had enough, and this time had my way. He accompanied me to the door of the study and held out his hand.
If by any chance you should want anything in the night, you will remember where to find me. I'm in there, he pointed. And now our evening is at an end. But who knows? Never matter. What must come, comes.
At last I was free. I made my way to Mr. Champney's bedroom and locked the door. The one thing in my mind was relief at finding myself alone again. No talker has ever more completely exhausted me than Mr. Bloom. Half-dressed, I lay down on the bed, drew its purple quilt over me, after all Mr. Bloom's secretary had not died in it, and blew out my candle. I must have at once fallen asleep. And now, as if in a moment, I was awake again, wide awake. Night had gone. The creeping grey dawn was at the window. I lay there, stiff and cold, eyeing the door. And then I heard the sound of voices at a distance. At that, a deadly chill came over me. I stepped soundlessly onto the floor, looked about me, but in vain in the half-light for the coat I had been wearing the previous night, and slipped on instead a pair of Mr. Champney's slippers and the silk dressing gown that hung on the door hook. In these I was not exactly myself, but at any rate ready for action. I unlocked the door. The voices were more distinct now. One of them, I fancied, was Mr. Bloom's, but there was a curious similarity between them. It might have been Mr. Bloom talking to himself. I listened, but could detect no words. And then the talking ceased. There came a thump, and then, overhead, the sound as of someone retreating towards me. Inaction is unnerving, and yet I hesitated, detesting the thought of meeting Mr. Bloom again. But that risk had to be taken. I tiptoed along the corridor and looked into his study. The curtain between the bookcases was drawn aside. I crossed the room and looked in. Beside a chair on which a black morning coat had been flung was a small bed, half covered by a rug, and standing next to it, a familiar pair of boots. On a table lay the miscellaneous contents, obviously, of Mr. Bloom's pockets. The old gold watch, a note case, a silver toothpick, a bunch of keys. I see them all. But I see even more distinctly a Yale key. Never, until this moment, had it occurred to me that Mr. Bloom himself might have been responsible for the loss of my key, that he had, in fact, purloined it. I stole nearer and examined it. Was this mine? I was uncertain. I must risk it. The footsteps seemed now to be thumping down the stairs, and it was unmistakably his voice that I heard. Yes, yes, coming, coming! Well, I had no wish to meddle in any assignation. What, as I turned round, I was not prepared for was the spectacle of Mr. Bloom's bed. When I entered the room, I am certain that it had been empty. Not so now. The lower part was entirely flat, but on the pillow, the grey-flecked beard protruding over the turned-down sheet now showed what appeared to be the head of Mr. Bloom. It was a flawless facsimile, waxen, motionless. But it was not real. It was an hallucination. How induced is quite another matter, but it was inconceivably shocking. This house was not haunted. It was infested. Without another glance at the bed, I made my way as rapidly as possible to the door and broke into a run. Just as I had left her the previous evening, my car stood awaiting me beneath the porch. My heart literally stood still as I inserted the key. But all was well. The first faint purring of the engine was accompanied by the sound of a window being flung open. It was above me and behind me. I turned my head and detected a greyish figure standing within the trees. But he too may have been pure illusion. When I blinked and looked again, he was gone. But the gabbling was increasing overhead. In an instant I'd shot out from under the porch and was on my way down the drive, but to my utter confusion the gates at the end of it were heavily padlocked. I all but stripped the gears in my haste to retreat, and then, without so much as turning my head towards the house, I drove clean across the lawn. In 5 minutes I must have been nearly as many miles from Mr. Bloom's precincts. It was fortunate perhaps the day was so early. Even the most phlegmatic of constables might look a little askance at a motorist desperately defying the speed limit in a purple dressing gown and red Morocco slippers. But I was innocent of robbery, for in exchange for these articles I had left behind a valuable jacket and a pair of leather shoes. I wonder what they'll fetch at the sale. I wonder if Mr. Bloom would have offered me Mr. Champney's £300 per annum if I had consented to stay. He was sorely in need, I'm afraid, of human company. But I ran away. Now it's too late to make amends. He has gone home, as we all shall, and taken his wages. And what troubles me is the thought of Miss Allgood. She dabbled her fingers in the obscure waters frequented by Mr. Bloom. I hate to think of the possibility of her meeting him. For whatever Mr. Bloom's company in his charming house may have consisted of, and here edges in the obscure problem of what the creatures of our thoughts are made on. And quite apart, too, from Mr. Bloom's character and effects, my chief quarrel with him was his scorn of my harmless old friend. I would like, if only I could, to warn her against him. Those affectionate, saddened, hungry eyes.
Anthony Head was reading A Recluse by Walter de la Mare. The producer was Lawrence Jackson. And we'll have another ghost story by Walter de la Mare tomorrow, when a man recalls the love affair he witnessed as a child and that will influence the rest of his life.
for the first Seventh Dimension of 2019, a sci-fi classic from Philip K. Dick.
I needed to find these androids, test them, and retire them.
What if they don't want to take the test?
You're going to have to act dumb. Hundreds of people get tested every week at Standard.
What if the test doesn't work and they pass, but I'm certain they're droids?
Retire them anyway.
All Hallows.
This show is supported by State Farm. Insurance is a part of any solid financial plan. Making sure you have the important things in life covered is one of the best ways to give yourself a little breathing room when things go awry. It's important to protect not only your business, but yourself as a business owner and all current and future team members. State Farm agents know what it takes to run and protect a small business because State Farm agents are all small business owners and they live and work in your community. So they're deeply attuned to what's happening with other small businesses in your market. If you have a small business and are interested in making sure you're protected, reach out to your local State Farm agent to learn more about what you need. They'll help you find the right policy at the right price for your business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
It was about 3:30 on an August afternoon when I found myself looking down upon All Hallows, and at first glimpse of it, every vestige of fatigue passed away. Having at last reached the end of my journey, dust, heat, wind, having come limping out upon the Green Sea Bluff beneath which lay its walls, I confess the actuality excelled my dreams of it. What most astonished me, perhaps, was the sense not of its age, but its air of abandonment. It lay couched there as if in hiding in its narrow sea bay. No other roof, not even a chimney, was in sight, only the dark blue arch of the sky and that gaunt coast fading away into the haze of a west over which were already gathering the veils of sunset. I should have come earlier. The distance was of little account, but 9 flinty hills in 7 miles is certainly hard commons. No, I shall not forget that walk or the conclusion of it, when all but dead beat, I stretched my aching limbs on the turf which crowned that last hill and feasted my eyes on the cathedral. I continued for a while to watch All Hallows, to spy upon it, and no less intently than a sentry, who, not quite trusting his eyes, has seen a shape approaching in the dusk. Those gigantic statues, for example, which flanked the base of the tower, images of angels and saints I had learnt from my guidebook. Only 6 of them could be visible from where I sat. And yet I found myself counting them again and again, for my first impression had been that 7 were in view. But what folly to have been frittering time away at an hour when no doubt the cathedral would soon be closed. There was but one faint chance left of making an entry, and so at last I found my way into All Hallows, entering by a dwarfish side door with zigzag mouldings. There hung for corbel to its dripstone a curious leering face, its forked tongue out to give me welcome, and an appropriate one too for the figure I made. But once beneath that prodigious roof tree, the hush, the coolness, the unfathomable twilight drifted in on my small human consciousness. Except for the windows over my head, filtering with their stained glass the last radiance of the sun, there was but little visible colour and an economy of decoration. To the east, a dark wooden multitudinously figured rood screen shut off the choir and the high altar from the nave. I seemed to have exchanged one universal actuality for another, the burning world of nature, for this oasis of quiet. 20 or 30 paces away, an old man was standing. To judge from the black and purple gown he wore, he was a verger. He had not realized, it seemed, that a visitor shared his solitude. He was listening. His head was craned forward, and as I watched, he raised his eyes and scanned the complete upper regions of the northern transept. He continued so long in the same position that I at last determined to break in on his reverie. At the sound of my footsteps, he turned. He resembled one of those old men whom Rembrandt delighted in drawing, the knotted hands, the black drooping eyebrows,
the thin-lipped ecclesiastical mouth. White as a miller with dust, hot and draggled, I was hardly the kind of visitor that any self-respecting custodian would welcome, but he greeted me with every courtesy. I apologized for the lateness of my arrival. Until I caught sight of you, I hadn't ventured far, otherwise I might have found myself a prisoner for the night. The old man smiled.
As a matter of fact, sir, the cathedral is closed to visitors at 4. Services are not as frequent as they were. Visitors are rare, too. We are too far out of the hurly-burly to be much intruded on. Not that them who come to worship are intruders, far from it, but most that come are mere sightseers.
Well, I cannot claim to be a regular churchgoer, I said. I am myself a mere sightseer, and yet even to sit here for a few minutes is to be reconciled.
Ah, reconciled, sir, the old man repeated. I can well imagine it after a journey on such a day as this, but to live here is another matter.
It must be desolate in winter.
We have our storms, sir, he agreed. You'd be astonished at the power of the winds.
I mustn't detain you, I said, but you were saying that services are infrequent now. Why is that?
Pray, don't think of keeping me, sir, but I was supposing you may have seen something that appeared in the newspapers. We lost our dean, Dean Pomfrey, last November.
I held my peace, and the old man, as if to make amends, asked me if I would care to see the building.
The light is smalling, he explained, but if we keep to the ground level, there'll be a few minutes to spare, and we shall not be interrupted if we go quietly on our way.
For the moment, the reference eluded me. I could only thank him for the suggestion. I explained, too, that I had read of Dr. Pomfrey's illness.
Aye, sir, a saint, if ever there was. But it's worse than illness, sir. It's oblivion.
He dropped his voice.
But sharing one's troubles is sometimes a relief. You see, sir, I am myself, and have been for 12 years now, the dean's verger. And our dean was a man who was all things to all men. None of your apron and gaiter high and mightiness whatsoever, sir. And then that. And to come on us without warning, or at least without warning as could be taken as such.
I followed his eyes into the darkening spaces above us. A light like tarnished silver lay over the soundless vaultings.
You must understand, sir, the old man continued. The procession for divine service proceeds from the vestry, out under the rood screen and into the chancel there. If you stand to the right, you will see the altar screen, 14th century work, Bishop Robert de Beaufort, a unique example. But what I was saying is that when we proceed for the services, it has always been our custom to keep close together. Well, on that afternoon, I had turned as usual to bow Dr. Pomfrey into his stall, when I found to my consternation he wasn't there. The old gentleman had left the vestry with us, that I knew, and then not a vestige. I hurried back, thinking he must have been taken suddenly ill. And yet, sir, I was not surprised to find the vestry vacant. No, our beloved dean was gone for ever. He had been,
the old man whispered the words,
abducted, sir.
Abducted?
He was found, sir, late that night, sitting in a corner, weeping, a child. He didn't know us, sir, didn't know me. Just simple, harmless, memory all gone. If you will just follow me, he whispered. There's a little place where I make my ablutions that might be of service, sir. We could converse there better.
The old man turned and led the way with surprising celerity and came to a nail-studded door. He opened it and admitted me into a recess under the central tower, whose only illumination was that of the ebbing dusk from within the cathedral. With trembling, rheumatic fingers, he lit a candle and pushed open another door.
You will find a basin and a towel in there, sir.
I entered. A print depicting the crucifixion was tacked to the wall, and beneath it stood a tin basin and jug on a stand. Never was water sweeter. I laved my face and hands and drank deep, my throat like a parched river course after a drought. When I returned, the old man was standing before the window.
All Hallows, I might say, sir, is my second home. I have been here, boy and man, for 55 years. Dr. Pomfrey might be with us now in his own self if only common caution had been observed. But now that the poor gentleman is gone beyond all that, there is no hope of action left. They meet and they have one expert, then another down from London. And I don't say they're not knowledgeable gentlemen, but why not tell all? Why keep back what we know? It's we, sir, and not the rest of the heedless world outside who are responsible. And what I say is, no power here or hereunder can take possession of a place while those inside have faith enough to keep them out. But once let that falter, the seas are in. And when I say no power, sir, I mean with all deference, even Satan himself.
What is wrong here? I asked.
Wrong, sir? Why, I am not doubting that the gentlemen I have mentioned have the salvation of the cathedral at heart, but they refuse to see how close to the edge of things we are and how we are drifting. So far as my knowledge tells me, there is no sacred edifice in the kingdom of a peace that is with All Hallows that is so open, open, I mean, sir, to an attack of this terrifying nature.
Terrifying?
Terrifying, sir. Where else, may I ask, would you expect the powers of darkness to congregate in open besiegement than in this narrow valley? First, the sea out there. Are you aware, sir, that ever since living remembrance, flood tide has been gnawing its way into this bay to the extent of 3 or 4 feet per annum? And think of the floods and gales that fall upon us autumn and winter through. They make the roads well nigh impassable.
Are you aware, sir, I continue, that as we stand now, we are above a mile from the nearest human habitation?
I warrant that if, and which God forbid, you had been shut up here during the night, and it was a near thing, but what you weren't, I warrant you might have shouted yourself dumb with not a human soul to help you.
Well, I smiled. As a small boy, one of my particular fancies was to spend a night in a pulpit.
But I take it, sir, if you had ventured to give out a text up there in the dark hours, your innocent young mind would not have been prepared for any kind of congregation.
You mean this place is haunted?
I mean, sir, that there are devilish agencies at work here.
He raised his hand.
Don't, I entreat you, dismiss what I am saying as the wandering of a foolish old man. I have heard them with these ears. I have seen them with these eyes, though whether they have any positive substance, sir, is beyond my small knowledge. But of what they can do, I can give you definite evidences.
But surely every old building is bound to show symptoms of decay.
I must apologize, the old man interrupted me. I'm a poor mouth at explanation, sir. Decay, settling, dissolution. I have heard these words bandied from lip to lip, and they fill me with nausea. Why? I'm speaking not of dissolution, sir, but of repairs, restorations, not decay, strengthening. Not a corroding loss, an awful progress. I could show you places, sir, where stones as rotten as pumice have been replaced by others fresh quarried, and nothing of their kind within miles. There are spots where massive blocks have been pushed into place by sheer force. All Hallows is safer at this moment than it has been for 300 years. They meant well. Them who came to see, full of fine talk, and went dumb away. But at heart, sir, they were cowed, horrified. He stood gazing through that narrow inward window.
I have not spent 60 years in this place without paying heed to my own thoughts. Look at your newspaper, sir. What they call the Great War is over, and he'd be a brave man who would take an oath before heaven that that was only of human designing. And yet, what do we see around us? Nothing but strife and juggleries and hatred wherever you look. And the church, sir. If you had told me that you were a regular churchman, I shouldn't be pouring out all this to you now. But being not so gives me confidence. By merely listening, you can help me, sir, though you can't help us.
You see, sir, he went on dejectedly, I can bear what may be to come.
Tell me the worst, and you will have done an old man a service he can never repay.
Tell me, on the other hand, that I am merely groping along in a network of devilish delusion, sir. Well, in that case, I hope to be with my master, with Dr. Pomfrey, as soon as possible. We were all children once. I sometimes find myself looking at a young child with little short of awe, sir, knowing that within its mind is a scene of peace and paradise of which we older folk have no notion, and which will fade away out of it as life wears in.
I was at a loss to answer him.
The fact is,
he looked cautiously about him,
what I am now being so bold as to suggest may put you in physical danger. On the other hand, we can leave the building at once, if you are so minded. In any case, we must be gone before dark sets in. Even mere human beings are best not disturbed at any night work. Besides, I once delayed too long myself.
Perhaps if I'd been a little less credulous or less exhausted, I should have begun to doubt this old creature's sanity. But then there was All Hallows itself to take into account. Even now, in this remote candlelit room, the vast edifice seemed to be gently and furtively fretting its impression on my mind.
I only wish I could be of any real help, I said.
The old man's expression changed, as if at the coming of a light.
Why then, sir, let us be gone at once. You are with me, sir. That was all I hoped and asked. Now there's no time to waste.
He lowered his voice.
What I would suggest, sir, if you've no objection, is your kindly grasping my gown. There will be a good deal of up and downing, but I know the building blindfold.
He opened the door and blew out the light. We were instantly marooned in an impenetrable darkness, and we set out on our expedition. I clung, I confess, desperately tight to my lifeline as we groped onward. I found myself steadily ascending, and then in a while, brushing along a gallery or corkscrewing up a new staircase. Once to recover our breath, we paused opposite a slit in the masonry at which to breathe the tepid sweetness of the outer air, and I caught a glimpse of the night's first stars. We then turned inward once more, ascending.
Dead still here, sir, if you please. There's a drop of some 60 feet a few paces on.
As we approached the edge of this stony precipice, the gloom paled a little, and I guessed that we must be standing in some coign of the southern transept. It seemed the northern windows opposite us were boarded up. Gazing out, I could detect scaffolding poles, like knitting needles, thrust out from the walls and a balloon-like spread of canvas above them. For the moment, my ear was haunted by what appeared to be the droning of an immense insect. But this presently ceased.
You will understand, sir, breathed the old man. The scaffolding over there was put up when the last gentleman came down from London to inspect the fabric. Now, sir.
I strained every sense, and yet I could detect not the faintest murmur under that wide-spreading roof. How long we stayed in this position, I cannot say. Minutes sometimes seem like hours. Then suddenly, without the slightest warning, I became aware of a peculiar vibration. It suggested the remote whirring of an enormous millstone. My companion pressed closer.
Do you see that, sir?
I gazed and gazed, but saw nothing. And then, though I cannot be certain,
It seemed that the voluminous spread of canvas perceptibly trembled as if a huge hand had been thrust out to draw it aside. No time was given me to make sure. The old man had hastily withdrawn me into the opening of the wall, and we made no pause in our retreat until we had come again to the narrow slit of window.
Well, sir.
It's so difficult to be sure of oneself. Have you ever actually encountered anything? Near at hand, I mean.
Well, yes, sir. In this very gallery. They nearly had me, sir. But by good fortune, there's a recess further on, stored up with some old fragments of carving. I had had my warning and managed to leap in there and conceal myself, but only just in time. Indeed, sir, I confess I was in such a condition of terror and horror, I turned my back.
You mean you didn't look, but something came?
Yes, sir. There was a sound like clanging metal, but I don't think it was metal. It drew near at a furious speed, then passed me, making a filthy gust of wind.
And no other sound?
No other, sir. Except in the distance, a noise like a stupendous kind of gibberish. No human sound. The air shook with it. You see, sir, I myself wasn't of any consequence, I take it, unless a mere obstruction. But I have heard it said that the rarity of these happenings is only because it's not any sort of pleasure for such beings, such apparitions, sir, good or bad, to visit our world. Did you hear anything then, sir?
His gentle mumbling ceased, and we listened together. But every ancient edifice has voices and soundings of its own. There was nothing audible I could put a name to, only a faint perpetual whir of grinding, such as, to overstimulated senses, the stablest stones set one on top of the other might make.
And now, sir, he continued with a sigh of weariness, would you perhaps follow me onto the roof? It is the last visit I make.
We had not far to go. The old man drew open a heavily ironed door at the head of a flight of stairs and admitted us at once to the leaden roof. The last faint hues of sunset were fading in the west. We edged softly along to find ourselves now all but tête-à-tête with the gigantic figures that stood sentinel at the base of the tower. The old man peered cautiously about him as we advanced. Once, with a hasty gesture, he drew me back and fixed his eyes on a figure which was silhouetted against the starry emptiness, a forbidding thing enough, viewed in this vague luminosity which seemed to be perceptibly stirring on its wind-worn pedestal. But no.
All's well, the old man signalled to me, and we pushed on.
At last we completed our circuit of the tower and stood eyeing one another like conspirators. Maybe there was a tinge of incredulity on my face.
No, sir, murmured the old man. I expected no other. The night is uncommonly quiet. They seem to leave us at peace on nights of quiet. But we must be getting home.
The notion of fumbling down again into the blackness was singularly uninviting. To gain a moment's respite, I inquired about getting a bed for the night in the village. And, as I had hoped, the old man himself offered me hospitality. I thanked him, but still hesitated to follow, for I was trying to discover what peculiar effect of darkness a moment before had deceived me into the belief that some small animal, a dog, I guessed, had taken cover behind the stone buttress nearby. But that apparently had been a mere illusion. Nothing stirred now. You were saying, I pressed him, that when repairs at the building were in contemplation, even the experts were perplexed by what they discovered. What did they say?
Say, sir? Examine that balustrade which you're leaning against. Look at that gnawing and fretting above the lead. All that is honest wear and tear, constant weathering of rain and wind. But now compare it, if you please, with this St. Mark here.
I stooped close under the huge grey creature of stone, and I confess I could find not the slightest trace of fret or friction. Far from it. The stone had been grotesquely decorated in low relief with a two-headed crocodile, and the undulations of the creature were cut as sharp as with a knife in cheese.
Now,
cast your glance upward, sir. Is that what you would call a saintly shape?
What I took to represent an eagle was perched on the image's lifted wrist, but lowering and vulture-like. The head of the figure was poised at an angle of defiance. Its whole aspect was undeniably sinister and intimidating.
Aye, sir, and so with some of the rest of them, the old man commented. There are other wills than the Almighty's.
But one doesn't repair in order to destroy.
No, sir, and why not? To give strength for evil purposes. Would that be time wasted, if such was your aim? An institution may be beyond dying, sir. It may be being restored for a worse destruction. And 100 trumpeting voices would make no difference when the faith and life within is tottering to its fall.
Somehow this muddle of metaphors reassured me. Obviously the old man's wits had worn a little thin. And yet you are taking it for granted, I expostulated, that if what you say is true, a stranger could be of the slightest help. The old man laid a trembling hand upon my sleeve.
Have patience with me, sir. I could never express the gratitude I feel. You have given me the occasion to unbosom myself, to make a clean breast, as they say. You couldn't help me, except only by your presence here. God alone knows who can.
At that instant, a dull, enormous rumble reverberated from within the building, as if a huge block of stone had been dislodged. The flags on which we stood seemed to tremble. The fingers tightened on my arm.
Come, sir, we must be gone at once. We have stayed too long.
But we emerged into the night at last without mishap. The little western door above which the grinning head had welcomed me on my arrival admitted us to terra firma again, and we made our way up the steep sandy track. We turned at the summit and looked back. All Hallows lay beneath us, resembling some natural prehistoric outcrop of that sea-worn, rock-bound coast, but strangely human and saturnine. But far out to sea, summer lightnings were now in idle play, flickering into the sky like the unfolding of a signal, planet to planet, then gone. That alone may have accounted for the faint vitreous glare that seemed to glitter across the windows of the northern transept. And yet how easily deceived is the imagination. I could have vowed this was no reflection, but the glow of some light shining fitfully from within, outwards. The old man paused beside the gate leading into his garden.
You will forgive me, sir, for mentioning it, but I make it a rule to leave all my troubles outside when I come home. My daughter is a widow, and not long in that sad condition, so I keep as happy a face as I can on things. And yet, well, sir, I wonder at times if a personal sacrifice isn't incumbent on them that have their object most at heart. I'd go out myself very willingly, sir, if there was any certainty in my mind that it would serve the cause. It would be little to me if...
He made no attempt to complete the sentence. On my way to bed that night, the old man led me in on tiptoe to show me his grandson. I stooped over the child's cot. The boy was of that fairness which almost suggests the unreal. He had flung back his bedclothes, as if innocence in this world needed no covering or defence, and lay at ease, the dews of sleep on lip, cheek, and forehead.
The lovely thing, I muttered. Where is he now, I wonder?
And from out of the distance, there came the first prolonged whisper of a wind from over the sea. It was 11 by my watch. The storm after the heat of the day seemed to be drifting inland, but All Hallows, apparently, had forgotten to wind its clock.
Richard E. Grant was reading All Hallows by Walter de la Mare. The producer was Lawrence Jackson. And we'll have another ghost story by Walter de la Mare tomorrow about two boys spending a holiday with a sinister aunt, an experience that will mark them forever.
Thanks to State Farm for supporting this show and helping our listeners protect their businesses and lives. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.